Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Brawley, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of X-Men Days of Future Past. Once again by Heath Holland. How you doing, Hollywood?
I'm doing great, and because the movie that we're talking about largely takes place in the 70s, I am wearing an ascot.
That is fantastic. I'm wearing bone claws. You can find our website at fthismovie.net. You should follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. You can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com or find us in the iTunes store by searching F This Movie. If you want to find all of our past episodes, however, it's 200 plus. You got to go to fthismovie.net. Hollywood Heath Holland, you are in a few weeks traveling to Wonderfest in Kentucky with JB. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, it's actually this as this episode drops, it's just days away.
Oh, this is exciting! Anything big going on at Wonderfest? I haven't looked at the itinerary.
I've looked at the itinerary, but you know what I'm mostly excited about is
holding hands with JB.
Yes. Who told you?
He did. He's excited too.
Yeah. No, I'm excited about the vendor tables. Just like. I haven't been to a convention in a long time, so just being able to walk among tables full of just the geekiest stuff in the world has me so excited.
Are you still full in the throes of your Godzilla kick? Because that could be dangerous going into Wonderfest.
I am still in the throes of passion with Godzilla, which is it is painful sometimes, but mostly Godzilla has been a gentle lover. And yeah, I'm like 10 deep, which I wish I was a little bit further, but you have to pace it because, my lord, it's overwhelming very quickly. But yes, I'm so excited about just like all the kaiju at Wonderfest.
Are you – you got to say it like kaiju. Are you going sequentially with Godzilla or just jumping around?
I am going sequentially.
That is impressive.
It's the only way.
Do you have a favorite so far?
Artistically, I think Mothra versus Godzilla, which I did my Netflix this movie about recently, was that's my – so far it's the best film that I've seen. But I watched one recently that had – it was Godzilla versus the Sea Monster, and I think the alternate title is the Horror from Below or something like that.
That sounds right.
Yeah. You know, and – It's just so crazy. It's the first one that they really broke from the he's coming on the land and attacking us. We got to run formula. What happens? This is just a setup for the movie. You've got these teenagers hanging out. They decide to get in a yacht and go out to sea. There's a thief on the yacht who's hiding out from the cops. They get lost at sea, crash on a desert, not a desert island, crash on a tropical island, stumble upon a secret military facility in the middle of this place run by a group of bad guys called the Red Bamboo. The lead bad guy has a eye patch on his eye. And then as they're running from these guys, they hide in a cave and that's where Godzilla is hibernating. So that's like the first 45, 50 minutes of the movie. Godzilla is just like, oh, you know, we can throw Godzilla in this too. And that'll be okay. It's almost like an afterthought for this awesome plot. It's totally awesome.
That seems to be – I've only watched a handful thus far, and that seems to be sort of par for the course where they all have a criminal element. Yeah. Or some of the other ones I've seen have an alien element, and the aliens are just also Japanese people but who wear like silver foil outfits and –
be sunglasses.
Yeah, right. And that's how we know that they are from another planet. But yeah, that Godzilla is sometimes incidental to the plot, not unlike 2014's Godzilla.
True. Very true.
But we've spoken enough about that. We're going to be talking X-Men Days of Future Past. We'll talk briefly, spoiler-free, in case you haven't seen the movie and you want to get our opinions on it, and then we will move fairly quickly into spoilers. I'm less concerned with spoilers on this one only because it's based on a pretty famous comic book, which maybe you've read. And if you've read the comic book and not seen the movie, you can certainly listen. I don't think we're going to be giving too much away. But before we do that, Hollywood, you've kind of already started talking about it, but besides 10 Godzilla movies, have you seen anything good lately?
I watched Gamera, the first Gamera movie, because Godzilla's not enough for me.
Right.
So I had to go deeper down the rabbit hole. I know you watched it too. Do you care to compare notes on that movie really quickly?
We could, if you like.
Okay. Well, I enjoyed it. I appreciate the differences. I mean, there's not a ton of differences, but there, the back of the Blu-ray box says, "Guardian of the Universe, friend of all children." Which, to me, I don't know. I just think that's hilarious. Like, he never really causes any human danger. He just kind of stumbles around and knocks things over. And he rescues a little boy from dying. So, and then he tucks into his shell and flies.
Yeah. He spins around real fast and then he flies.
Right, like a little top, like a little turtle top.
Yeah. For a long time, I referred to you as Guardian of the Universe and friend to all children. it seemed like for that first Gamera, they sort of used the original Godzilla template, where it's a little bit darker. I mean, again, he's a friendlier monster overall, but for some of the movie, he seems like a scary threat, and then he saves the boy, and that's happy. And I believe, like with the Godzilla series, that in later installments of the Gamera franchise, he's more just sort of the superhero from the outset.
Yeah, well, I hope so.
I believe that's – I haven't watched them yet. I have, I think, 7 more to get through, but I haven't started.
Yeah, there's other ones too. There's a whole run from the 90s as well. Do you know about those?
I think I know that they exist, but I haven't seen any of them.
Yeah, I haven't either, but I probably will because that's what I do.
I did not realize when I ordered some of those more those Godzilla double features that Sony just put out that that none of them are from like the 60s or 70s. It's all of the 90s and 2000s run.
Right. Yeah.
So I only watched Godzilla Final Wars so far, and you know it's not great, but it's fine.
How does it compare to Godzilla 2014?
You know, you can't really compare the two because one is much more concerned with being an actual movie. And I think Godzilla 2014 kind of falls short as an actual movie, whereas Godzilla Final Wars is just about being a crazy victory lap for Godzilla because it was sort of the last Toho movie that was being made. And so they bring back every monster he ever fought. There's even sort of a joke about, at one point, a monster shows up that I believe is just referred to as Zilla, that is clearly modeled on the Roland Emmerich design, and he lasts about 4 seconds before Godzilla just beats the shit out of him. So there's their commentary on the Emmerich Godzilla. So it's fun to watch for reasons like that, but it's very heavy on the aliens in silver LeMay outfits coming to invade our planet and engaging in kung fu with some mutants from Earth, which ties in, of course, nicely to the show we're doing tonight. Anything besides Gamera that you've seen?
Yeah, well, one other thing, and it's not – I mean, everybody's seen it, but a couple of weeks ago they put out a re-release of the first Rocky movie on Blu-ray.
Okay.
And I wanted to check it out because it's supposed to have been remastered. They put out a new box set. I have the first Blu-ray box set, which is, they put these crazy titles on these things. It's like the Undisputed Collection.
I think that's the one I have.
Yeah, so the new one has, I think the only difference is the Rocky disc, which has been remastered and supposed to look a lot better, and it has a few new extras on it. So rather than buy the new box set, I just bought that disc on its own. And it does look better, but what I was kind of excited about is it has a special feature of, it's like 8 minutes of 8mm home video footage from Lloyd Kaufman, who was the production manager on that movie, that he found in his basement recently. And so it's him, or he and John Avildsen talking about just talking about it. So it's like behind the scenes footage of the the staircase, the steps, running up the steps. And they have behind the scenes footage of that. It didn't amount to as much as I had hoped it would. And it still doesn't look great. The remaster does not look great. I guess Rocky never looked great because it was kind of a low budget movie. So I don't know. I guess an upgrade on that would come down to how much you want those 8 minutes of behind the scenes footage.
I'm a sucker for anything with Lloyd Kaufman, but I will probably not be upgrading my Rocky disc. I've owned Rocky on DVD for at least 10 years, never watched it. Now I've had the Blu-ray collection for 6 months to a year. I believe it's still in the plastic wrap. So one of these days I'm just going to marathon all of them, but I haven't gotten in that mood yet, so I can't imagine upgrading a disc that I have yet to watch. Are you a big Rocky fan? I'm kind of a take it or leave it guy.
Yeah, I am. I don't love all of them. Five's a tough sit.
That's, I think, the only one. That and Rocky Balboa are the only two I ever saw in a theater.
Okay. I don't know that I saw any of them in a theater, to be honest with you. Not even the last one. But I do love Four, especially Four. I mean, that's a classic.
Well, that's because it's got your boy Dolph in it.
Does have my boy Dolph in it. I also like Three. So, yeah, I guess I am. I have drank the Rocky Kool-Aid.
Yeah. Three is the one I grew up on because it was on cable the most. And I think if pressed, that's the one I would want to watch because to me it's like the tackiest. It's very much the most 80s. It's very much of its time.
Which is the one with the robot in it?
Oh.
Three or is that?
It might be Four. And right now people's heads are exploding because we don't know. Yeah. It's Three or Four.
Sorry.
It seems like it would be Three just because of when it was made, but Three has thunder lips. I don't know. Yeah, it's Three or Four. And I actually, when I saw Rocky Balboa in a theater, I thought it was okay. I thought they did a good job of trying to update it or, you know, do something that sort of honored the franchise without being too awful.
Yeah, it was during that time when Sylvester Stallone was just putting codas on everything he'd ever done.
Right. And now we have The Expendables 3 coming out, which news just broke this week that it's PG-13. That's got to have you excited, right?
Oh, yeah. That's so why I want to take my family to see The Expendables 3.
That's why we go to those movies, so that they can cut away from the violence.
That's right. That's right. Go ahead.
He even said in a quote something about, like, well, hopefully we'll get it right this time, or something to that effect. And I think he was talking more specifically about the amount of action or the amount of violence, but I just thought, like, why are you making a part three if you are acknowledging? He had said the first two, oh, it was about, like, the balance of action and comedy, that the first one is too serious and they went too funny for the second one, which I would beg to differ, but okay.
Too many wet jokes in the second one.
Right. And so this time he feels like they got it right. Don't do a part three if you feel like one and two didn't get it right.
That's upsetting. Did you ever watch the director's cut of the first one?
I still have not. I own it because I was able to find it for like $5, but I still have not watched it.
Maybe you should. I don't know.
I worry that I'm not well-versed enough. This is always the problem with director's cuts, is that I feel like I have to watch the original version two or three times before then I can watch the director's cut and really spot the differences. There are certainly movies when the 2.5-hour cut of That Thing You Do came out, I was able to watch that, and I could tell you every single shot that was different. But movies that I'm not as well-versed in, like they just announced the Halloween collection coming out in September, and it's great, and it's this big deal, although I could not be more frustrated because I have bought those movies so many goddamn times. Right now, I have three versions of multiple Halloween movies sitting on my shelf. I have the Universal Halloween 2, then I have the Scream Factory Halloween 2, then I have Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, and then I have the original Anchor Bay Halloween, and then the 35th Anniversary Remaster Halloween, and then Rob Zombie's Halloween. So half of my shelf is taken up just by Halloween movies, and they have the producer's cut of Curse of Michael Myers coming out, which I'm convinced is the only reason I'm going to buy this whole set, because it's never been available as anything but a bootleg. And I don't even really like the Curse of Michael Myers, but I'm so interested to see the producer's cut. But that means I have to sit down and watch Curse of Michael Myers probably two or three times before I can watch the producer's cut and really understand the changes.
Yeah, it's, you know, and they bank on people like us too, because we will buy it.
Yeah.
It's a sickness.
I know, and they announced it, and I'm all, take my money. I rewatched, for a review over at DVD Verdict, I rewatched Countess Dracula, which just came out on Blu-ray, courtesy of Synapse, and it's a Hammer film from 71 or 72, starring Ingrid Pitt, which is the whole reason to watch it. It is not a vampire movie, despite what the title would suggest. It is sort of a loose retelling of the legend of Countess Elizabeth Báthory, who used to bathe in the blood of virgins to remain young. And I dig the movie. I recognize it's not very good, but Ingrid Pitt made two Hammer movies right in a row. She made that a year after she made The Vampire Lovers, which is also available on Blu-ray, and a ton of fun for all of its ridiculous sort of lesbian salaciousness. Ingrid Pitt is very, very stunning and worth seeing the movie just for her. The movie's crazy, but I really dig it. And, of course, the big feather in my cap this weekend was that I got to see Blended, the new Adam Sandler movie. I have another gig where I have to write about these movies that comedians make. And so I have seen every Adam Sandler movie in a theater since like 2008, I think. And he's good for maybe one a year. And I saw Grown Ups in a theater. I saw Grown Ups 2. I've seen all of the Happy Madison movies, every Kevin James movie, every Bucky Larson that comes along. I have to go and review it. So I saw Blended, and the great news is it's not his worst movie. That's my rave review.
It's not his worst movie.
Exactly. It is a bad movie, but better than his last few. It feels slightly less lazy. Drew Barrymore, who tends to... Every Drew Barrymore movie I watch, I go through the same cycle, which is for the first hour, she irritates me because she's like overly precious and adorable, and she has her cute little lisp, and I just think, Drew Barrymore, just be a person. And then in the last hour, she always wins me over, and I think, oh, I like Drew Barrymore. And she maybe raises his game. I don't know.
How does it compare to, say, a 50 First Dates? Has it gone downhill, or are we just kind of treading water?
I'm not the world's biggest 50 First Dates fan. What's that?
I don't know why not.
Yeah, right. When I saw it in a theater, and it was like, fine. It was pleasant enough. I don't really remember it. I feel like this is worse because that was still trying to be a movie and this one isn't. Although, I mean, again, Sandler is not just phoning it in. It's not just about him hanging out with his friends. Yes, they go to Africa, and it's obvious that that's just so that he and his friends could get a paid vacation to Africa, because they very easily could have set the story in the United States. They could have just sent them to Disney World for as much of Africa as we actually end up seeing. They spend most of their time at a resort in Africa, which you could have just gone to Animal Kingdom in Orlando. But whatever, then they couldn't have gone to Africa. So he's upped his game a little. Drew Barrymore obviously creates some sympathy. Like, some of the actors seem to be trying, which is more than I could say of his last few efforts. But 50 First Dates, if memory serves, tried to look like a movie and feel like a movie. And this, if you're a person who pays attention to things like photography and editing, and I'm assuming if you're listening to a movie podcast, you are that kind of a person. I can't think of a movie that I've seen recently that cared less about sort of the formal aspects of filmmaking. It's very much just point and shoot in the flattest, most everyone's in the center of the frame. Things don't ever quite cut together the way they should. It's seven steps below television filmmaking. I mean, it's so clumsy and lazy in terms of the filmmaking. And I feel like 50 First Dates wasn't like that, but maybe I'm just remembering it more fondly than I should.
No, I don't think it was that bad. I actually don't remember a ton about 50 First Dates, but I do remember thinking when I left the theater, well, that was fine. I haven't thought about it a lot since then, but I have not a pleasant memory of it, but it's okay. Did any of the jokes land? Is it funny at all, or is it just his man-child bit for 2 hours?
He's not doing a man-child. He's doing more kind of a sad sack. And there were definitely jokes. It's weird because I feel like the movie is being positioned as sort of a family movie, maybe because it's about two families coming together. But there are so many just dirty jokes and vagina jokes, and there's a whole run about, like, tampons being too big for a teen vagina, and they're for a much bigger vagina. And the message is fine, because what it's saying ultimately is, you know, kids need two parents, and boys need a dad, and girls need a mom. And like, that's fine. If you're somebody who totally believes that, I'm not going to argue with you. I think it's a little bit bullshit. Because in the way that it's argued in this movie, he's raising three daughters because he lost his wife. And he's raising them all as boys. They wear tracksuits and they have boy haircuts. And it's like, oh, girls need a mom. Well, not necessarily. Girls just need a different dad. Like, a dad could raise three healthy, fine girls as a single parent. But the argument is because he's a dummy, he raises them as boys. And so, hey, don't all girls need a mom? Well, sure, if that works out, but not necessarily. Lots of, you know, well-adjusted, productive kids can come from single-parent households. So I call bullshit on that a little bit. I'm not, you know, the movie's not like insidiously dangerous or anything because it's a fucking Adam Sandler movie. Who cares? But I do kind of have to call bullshit on that.
So what I'm hearing you say, the Adam Sandler movie is clumsy and wrong-headed and maybe a little ham-fisted.
But not his worst movie.
But not his worst movie. Do you want to say what you think that is?
His worst movie?
Nikki, maybe, or...
No, I don't think it's Little Nicky at all. It's got to be one of his last two. I feel like it's a toss-up between Jack and Jill and Grown Ups 2. And for different reasons. Like, Jack and Jill is shrill and unpleasant and aggressively unfunny, and Grown Ups 2 isn't a movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was my exciting weekend. Should we move on to X-Men Days of Future Past?
We should probably stop talking about Adam Sandler and talk about X-Men.
Listen, yeah. I could do a whole show on Blended if you want. So here's the deal. Like I said, we're going to talk spoiler-free for a couple of minutes, but I want to address this because we've encountered some things recently. What I've discovered is anytime we do a show on a comic book property, sort of a big genre blockbuster, people discover us for the first time. And sometimes they get really upset because we don't like the thing that they like, or maybe we do like the thing that they don't like. So if you're just tuning in to F This Movie for the first time, welcome. We hope you'll stay with us. We hope you like our conversation. But we're not just going to say, this is 100% great, and this is 100% terrible. We will like or dislike the movie, and then we'll talk about the reasons why. And I'll give up the lead right now. I liked Days of Future Past. I think it has some problems, and I'm going to be talking about what I think those problems are, in addition to what I liked about the movie.
It's 100% great.
If you can handle that, please continue to listen, and we love to have you. If it's going to upset you because you think this movie is a flawless masterpiece and you will suffer no criticisms, this is not the podcast for you. And I apologize to all of you who have been listening for a long time and who already know this and understand this, but I just wanted to get that out up front. So, I have already said I generally liked X-Men Days of Future Past. I have liked, in varying degrees, all of the X-Men movies, with the exception of X-Men Origins Wolverine, which I think is one of the worst Hollywood blockbusters of the last decade. But I even find things to like in X-Men The Last Stand, and we could talk about that a little bit later. I think all of the X-Men movies are good in a lot of ways. I think they all come with a lot of problems. I don't think this one is any different, but overall, I enjoyed it. How about yourself, Triple H?
Yeah, ditto.
So we're good? We're done?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Have fun at Wonderfest.
I agree. That's exactly how I feel, actually, which is probably not going to make super interesting podcasting, but we'll hash it out, so it'll be all right. But yeah, I like it. I think I like parts of it very much. I don't love it, and there are definitely some things in here that really bothered me that I wish weren't there. But overall, I liked it, and I thought it was a lot better than I was expecting it to be.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was not necessarily looking forward to it for a number of reasons. One, if I've read the book on which it is based, it was a long time ago, so I really don't remember, so I wasn't comparing it. So because I wasn't as familiar with the source material, maybe I wasn't looking forward to it as much. The trailers didn't have me real excited. Bryan Singer's last few movies have not thrilled me. And I liked the Wolverine a lot, but, you know, the franchise has been sort of on a steady decline from The Last Stand to X-Men Origins. So there was very little about it that really had me excited. And yeah, like you, I thought it was better than I was anticipating. And I feel like part of me was grading it on a curve, because if you have been listening to this podcast, you know, 2 weeks ago we did The Amazing Spider-Man. I didn't love it. Last week we did Godzilla. I didn't love it. And the reasons for not loving those movies were similar. I didn't think they worked as movies. I didn't think they had clear stories or well-defined characters or themes that you could sort of look at and embrace. This movie had all those things. This was a movie. It had a story. It had characters. They had arcs. There were themes that you could pull out of the movie and talk about. So I'm wondering how much of it I was liking just because it felt good to see one of these big Hollywood blockbuster types that just functions dramatically, because that is going away. You know, a lot of these
movies going away. I was going to say, so few movies that come out between the months of April and August do function as actual movies. They're just spectacle. And this one had more to chew on, and I really appreciated that.
I was actually having this, and this is going to fucking make people crazy. I was having this conversation with Doug the other night. We were talking, and he said he got caught up watching Armageddon on cable. And he said he had to stop what he was doing and possibly cancel the recording of a show he actually wanted to see so that he could continue to watch Armageddon. And maybe Armageddon one of these days will get its own podcast, because, listen, I recognize Armageddon is a stupid movie and a very silly movie, and for many people is held up as the point at which, you know, blockbusters got terrible, that Michael Bay came along and hijacked the summer movie and ruined it. And a lot of that is true. I'm not going to defend Armageddon necessarily as a good movie. However, it does a lot of these things that we're talking about. It has a story. It has well-defined characters, even if they are simplistic, who have arcs. And I look at Armageddon now and I see it, you know, again, a stupid movie, a loud, aggressively obnoxious, badly edited, badly shot movie that is sort of dramatically sound for as stupid as it is. And I know that may seem like a ridiculous statement, but I think it's kind of true. And that is going away. And we spent a lot of time talking about that on the Spider-Man podcast, so I won't rehash that. But I feel like, if nothing else, X-Men Days of Future Past, while to me has a lot of weird logic gaps and continuity issues.
Listen, I've read X-Men for 20 years. I have more X-Men comic books than I have any other comic book. I have hundreds of X-Men comic books, and this movie confused me confused in a long time. I was like, wait a minute. So that person is this person, okay, go ahead.
So talk about a little bit your history with the – obviously you're a huge fan of the comic, and again, I don't read comics as much as I used to or collect them because it's too expensive. But for a long time, the two titles that I really collected were Spider-Man and X-Men. And when I sold off a lot of my comics, the ones that I held on to were all my Spider-Man and all my X-Men. So I'm a fan as well. But talk a little bit about your history with the movie franchise.
Okay, so X-Men, the first Bryan Singer X-Men movie was, 2000, I believe, right? So
yeah.
That was the first – we'd had Blade before that, I guess. But – X-Men was the first one that really meant something to me, because it was like, hey, here's this thing. I mean, I guess it was Batman when I was a kid, but X-Men, it really hit me in the right way at the right time. Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. I mean, it was like, you know, I had been dreaming about something like that for so long, and it took the characters relatively seriously. And then when X2 came along, it seemed to just up the ante and made it seem even more, I don't know. It was just building to a crazy crescendo. And you just knew that the next movie, the third movie, was going to be the one that paid all this off. And it was like almost like Star Wars back in the day, when you have Empire Strikes Back and you're like, what is going to happen in the next movie? And then X3, X-Men The Last Stand came out, and it really bothered me. I actually do not like that movie at all. But you said that you find some things to like about it, and I'd love to hear what they are.
When it gets to the climactic battle, I think that – I just like that for a large chunk of the movie, it really kind of cuts loose, and it has the highest budget of all the movies, and I'm sure that's why, where – there's a big fight where it's all just mutants fighting mutants, and you finally get to see what it looked like in the comic book, because the previous two movies only have very short bursts of that, where you get a little bit of somebody using a power and a little bit of somebody using a power, and it's usually kind of in a one-on-one situation, and the effects aren't great. By the time you get to the end of X-Men: The Last Stand, it kind of cuts loose, and it just looks like what I had been reading in comic books, where mutants are fighting mutants, and it felt big, and everybody's using a power, and it's this big, badass brawl. I agree that the movie is a mess, and, you know, Brett Ratner gets all of the hate for that, and I understand Brett Ratner is not an easy guy to like. He doesn't make it easy for himself to like him. I think he has made some bad movies. I also think he's made a handful of movies that are, you know, okay to good. And he gets all the blame for X-Men: The Last Stand. And I feel that that is very unfair. He was hired to do a job at the very last minute because Bryan Singer had left. Matthew Vaughn walked after doing a lot of the pre-planning and walked. And Brett Ratner inherited a movie with a release date and a mandate from Tom Rothman at Fox saying, you have to do this, this, and this. And it was going to be the last X-Men movie. They were going to end the franchise there. And because the movie was so crazy successful, I believe it was the highest grossing of all of them at that point. Obviously, they continued, you know, and they made X-Men Origins Wolverine, and now they're back with Days of Future Past, and they did First Class. I think Brett Ratner had a terrible situation, and obviously that movie has a ton of problems, many of which are the decisions to kill off characters, take away the powers of other characters. Its greatest sin, of course, is that the end, the final shot of X2 promised us Dark Phoenix, and X-Men: The Last Stand really, really underdelivered on that particular storyline. And so that's, you know, I think its greatest sin is that it tried to do Dark Phoenix and did it really, really badly. It has other issues too, where it switches from day to night inexplicably, and there it dramatically doesn't make a ton of sense. But I don't think Brett Ratner deserves all of the blame for, I think Tom Rothman is really the guy that you should be pointing to and saying, this guy really fucked up X-Men. But that is a total tangent. So then they come back with X-Men First Class, and what are your feelings on that?
You know, I like X-Men First Class a lot. I thought that it reinvigorated a franchise that I had kind of stopped caring about. After X-Men Origins Wolverine, I think I commented on it at some point. That movie made me angry. I mean, rarely does a movie make me angry. I'm usually just apathetic. I'm like, well, you know, whatever. And then I'm on to something else. But that movie it made me aggressively angry at just the decisions and the lack of any. Okay, so we're talking about movies by studio or movies by committee, right? And to go back to what you're saying about X-Men 3 really quick, is that movie does really feel like something that was made with no clear no person in charge. There's no one at the steering wheel of that thing. It doesn't seem like. So I agree that it's not necessarily Brett Ratner's fault. But then they followed it up with a movie that's almost just as bad. It's like, well, what can we put in here?
Oh, it's way worse. I think X-Men Origins Wolverine is way worse than X-Men: The Last Stand.
Probably is. I honestly haven't watched it since it was new.
No, I haven't either.
First Class fixes. I don't know. It just puts like people, like character, back into the franchise, which it really needed. And I think that the casting that they did, and James McAvoy, I want to talk about him later. I thought he was great in First Class. Side note, I think I prefer McAvoy to Patrick Stewart. Is that crazy?
No, I do too. I mean, Patrick Stewart does what is asked of him and obviously was, you know, sort of born to play Charles Xavier. And so they were smart to cast him, and he's fine as the Elder Professor X, but he's an uninteresting character as portrayed in those first three X-Men movies, whereas young Charles Xavier is terrific. He's so good and interesting, and McAvoy is one of those guys who I never think of when I'm thinking of actors I really like, and then every time I see him in something, I'm like, holy shit, man, that guy is really good. I really like him.
Have you seen Filth, by the way?
I've not seen Filth yet.
I don't know if it's I don't think it's out yet, but I was wondering if you'd had access to it. I can't wait to see that movie.
I'm fascinated by it, especially as I become a bigger fan of James McAvoy. Yeah, I thought he was great. I wonder how much Matthew Vaughn, I really like the first hour or so of X-Men First Class. I have some problems with the second hour, and I rewatched it in anticipation for this. And I've talked about it before on the podcast because I think that was the first X-Men movie to come out while we were a thing, while if this movie existed. And I like a lot of the movie. It's just when it gets into a lot of the prequel stuff where it has to do kind of table setting and make references to him going bald and everyone choosing a name. I mean, it really sinks like a stone, all that kind of stuff. But the casting is great, and all the stuff with Magneto running around, it makes you want Fassbender to play James Bond for sure.
Oh, yeah.
So I wonder how much of the credit actually Matthew Vaughn sort of deserves for the success of Days of Future Past, because Bryan Singer, I think, gains a lot from inheriting Matthew Vaughn's cast.
Absolutely.
Because that's one of the best things about the movie. And I do think it was very clever the way that they sort of married the two franchises together, because I would have thought that was impossible. Once they did First Class, one of the things that actually bothered me when I saw First Class is because my understanding was that they were essentially rebooting the franchise.
Yeah.
And they sort of were, but then they kept tying it back into the Singer films, because there's a scene where they go to see Wolverine in a bar, and it's played by Hugh Jackman, and he says, fuck off. And there's another shot with Rebecca Romijn as Mystique. And I wondered at the time, well, if you're trying to be your own thing, why wouldn't you be your own thing? Because now, in this universe that you've established, Hugh Jackman is Wolverine. If you ever want to do Wolverine again, you're tied into Hugh Jackman. And so then Days of Future Past comes along with a very clever way of marrying those two things together. And I think that was really smart, and I'm really happy with the way that they pulled it off.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I guess if we're going to be talking specifics pretty soon, we should segue into spoilers. I haven't read the book, but I know that in the book, Kitty Pryde is the central character, basically, that she's the one who's going back in time to warn the X-Men, and because Hugh Jackman is the person around whom this franchise is sort of built, they changed it to be Wolverine. And Mystique, I don't believe, factored in as heavily in the original Days of Future Past book, but Jennifer Lawrence is now a movie star, so the movie is very Mystique, Jennifer Lawrence heavy. I've never necessarily loved the character of Mystique as done in the movies. I've liked her relationship with Magneto. I like Rebecca Romijn in the part, actually. And I like that she's sort of this weird sidekick, maybe girlfriend, but they just have this weird relationship that's ill-defined. And that was one of the things that bothered me about First Class, where it was – not First Class, Last Stand, is how casually it just discards Mystique and Magneto forgets about her because she loses her powers. And there was a lot of that kind of just shitty, short-sighted decision-making that really hampers that movie. And in ways that we can't discuss yet, I was interested in how – Days of Future Past tried to correct a lot of that.
Yes. Has something happened with Rebecca Romijn that she's not in this at all? Is there a reason for that? Because I've missed her very much.
Well, we can't really talk about it until we get into spoilers.
Okay, fair enough.
So why don't we go ahead and do that? If you haven't seen Days of Future Past yet, we're now going to get into specifics. I think it's worth seeing if you're a fan of any of the X-Men movies. I think it's I don't even think I could rank them. There was a lot of discussion about the X-Men movies last week on the website. Adam Riske had written a column, and even Devin Faraci over at Badass Digest, suddenly they're being reassessed as being mostly bad movies, including the first movie. I kind of like, especially the first two, and I recognize the flaws of the third one. I find things to like in it, and maybe it's just because I like the X-Men movies, but I still don't even think the first movie is bad. I think it has a ton of problems, some of which are budgetary, some of which are just the fact that Bryan Singer was kind of first out of the gate, obviously post-Blade, like you had said. But yeah, that this was the movie that showed, oh, there's a way to do this. There's a way to treat this material and make this stuff work in a movie. And X-Men deserves a lot of credit for that, and I think it gets a ton of stuff right. I think it comes more in moments. And I think that's almost true of all of the X-Men movies.
Yeah.
I think that's even sort of true of Days of Future Past. While I do think it ultimately ties together and is about some interesting things, I think it's a movie that works best in select moments, that there are things that you remember when it's over and you say, oh, that was cool and that was fun and, oh, I liked this performance or this scene more so than you remember the sum of the parts, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And I'm so glad to hear you say that, too, because you're right. There has been kind of a reassessment of these movies. It's not being very good. But listen, we were there. These movies were a big deal when they first came out. Not even when they first came out. I mean, for years, these movies were they were pioneers for superhero movies. And now maybe that's not such a great thing because we have this glut of superhero movies. But back then, we hadn't seen the things that we've seen now. So I believe Ferracci's headline or his tagline was, finally, Bryan Singer makes an X-Men movie worth seeing. And I feel like that's so unfair and so reductive.
Well, and I also think it's not worlds apart from his other X-Men movies. Like, if you liked this movie, I don't necessarily see why you would have hated his other two, because I feel like they're all – this one's bigger in scope. It has better actors and better performances, and I think it's a little more consistent than especially the first X-Men. But again, I cut that first X-Men kind of some slack. Okay, so we're going to get into spoilers. If you haven't seen the movie yet, go ahead and tune out. If you have, stick with us. One of the things that I want to talk about is the cast, because after seeing this movie yesterday, very late last night, I put on the original X-Men and rewatched it. And that was where a lot of the sort of continuity issues were jumping out at me, because at one point, Patrick Stewart says something about Magneto's helmet. Apparently he has this helmet that blocks out me trying to read his thoughts. And it's like, no. If you've seen First Class, there's a whole thing about it. I mean, the movies tend to ignore their own continuity. And there was a lot of stuff in even Days of Future Past that I felt like, this is a weird shortcut. This doesn't totally make sense, even the way that it's explained. Well, we have to send Logan back because his mind heals faster. It can heal as fast as it's being torn apart. So he's the guy. And it's like, well, okay, I'll accept that as the premise because I have to, otherwise there's no movie. But there were moments of that where it's like, that's asking me to swallow a lot, but okay, I'll go along with it, Days of Future Past, because I basically like you. There was a movie that I was watching recently with Famke Janssen, and I don't remember what it was. And I was watching her, and I don't have any major problems with her, but I'm also not a huge fan. I'm basically indifferent. And I was watching her and thinking about, oh, she played Jean Grey. She played one of the most important characters in one of the most important comic book franchises. And I mean X-Men the book. I'm not even talking about the movies necessarily. That if you're an X-Men fan, Jean Grey is really kind of a linchpin. And I was thinking about all of the cast of the original X-Men and how at the time, because of the budget, because people weren't sure they were this unknown commodity, Bryan Singer was very limited in who he could get as his cast. And I feel like if the movie's being made today, Famke Janssen is not being cast as Jean Grey, and James Marsden is not being cast as Cyclops, and Tyler Mayne is probably not being cast as Sabretooth or whatever, that they would get maybe bigger names or more interesting actors. And you can kind of see that even with First Class, which, while at the time Fassbender and James McAvoy weren't necessarily household names, they are better actors who might have turned that same thing down in 2000. And so it was interesting to see, we're in spoilers now, so we can talk about that, to see those actors brought back because Singer inherited sort of the better cast with Jennifer Lawrence and Fassbender and McAvoy. But then he still got, you know, Ian McKellen, which I still argue is pretty brilliant casting, and Patrick Stewart. But then to see Famke Janssen and James Marsden come back at the end, I was weirdly happy about that, because what he has essentially done is he has de-Ratnered the franchise, which is to say he has sort of course-corrected the mistakes made by X-Men The Last Stand. And, you know, the reason he didn't do that movie is because he went off to do Superman, and that movie had just a troubled production, X-Men The Last Stand. It went through, you know, three different directors. So it's interesting to see now that he's back, he's trying to get it back to the place where it might have been had he not left to go do Superman. And so that means going forward that we are you know, still saddled with Famke Janssen and James Marsden as Cyclops and all that. But I was actually happy to see them return.
But I was so excited. Did you know ahead of time that they were going to be in that?
I absolutely did not. So that was a pleasant surprise that wasn't ruined for me by the internet.
Yes, I stayed away from like every review and everything that anything that was talking about the movie until after I'd seen it. And I was so happy. And I didn't expect to be because I didn't think that I had any particular affection for that original cast. But apparently I do, because when Logan looks up and sees the red hair, I was like, oh, shit, is it? And then it was. And like I was expecting there to be some weird, you know.
Yeah, like a misdirect.
Yeah. And it wasn't. Yeah. Like, well, good for you.
Well, right. I think that's less about like, oh, I'm so excited to see Famke Janssen back in a movie, as it is about like, oh, good, you're going to ignore that bullshit from X-Men The Last Stand, yeah, where Cyclops dies at a lake for no reason than so that he can go do Superman Returns with Bryan Singer.
Yeah, it's like it took you 7 years, but you finally gotten this thing back to the place where I lost interest in it the first time.
Right.
It made me so happy.
I was delighted when Kelsey Grammer walked through the hall, because
yes,
that's one of the things I liked about
The
Last Stand was the casting of Kelsey Grammer, which, you know, Matthew Vaughn deserves the credit for that. But it was just a fun little cameo that hadn't been spoiled for me and that I thought was like this neat little treat. Oh, wow, they got Kelsey Grammer to come back and spend hours in the makeup chair to do that one little walk by. And then it just improved from there, because then you realize, oh, they've actually gone back and... And I had read, maybe it was with Adam Riske, I think he was tweeting about the movie, and one of the things that he said, he didn't love the movie, and one of the things he didn't like was that he felt like its existence negated the other X-Men movies.
Yeah.
But I don't even think that's true, because I feel like that's the way that Star Trek 09 found a way to create a different continuity that didn't negate everything that came before. That's kind of how I feel about this. I think, you know, you can still watch all the things that came before and still enjoy those and now just see this as sort of the alternate timeline. So I don't think it undoes all of the other movies by saying, oh, they don't matter, none of that shit matters. I think it's just saying, no, we're going down this path now. And yeah, it's a path where things didn't get fucked up by Tom Rothman, but can't we all agree that that's a good thing?
Yes, and you know, I think that it if you like those movies, they're still there and they still happened. They're still in continuity somehow. And that's,
right.
You know, as these movies continue, all comic book movies with Marvel's 2028 plan that they've got laid out, you're going to have missteps. You're going to have things that don't work as well as you'd like them to, or things that aren't thought out well because they're being run by a group of people who don't have the best interest in necessarily creating the best, service to the characters, in my opinion. And things like this are so encouraging for me because this is, oh, okay, well, we're acknowledging that happened, but we're also taking it and we're using it as fuel to get us to this other place where we can, we'll open this door and now this avenue is available to us where we didn't have it before, but we couldn't have gotten there if we hadn't had the mistakes, you know, in quotes, from the past that led us there. And, you know, I've been on a thing lately about respect and respecting the characters, and I'm still trying to actually get to the bottom of what it is that I'm trying to say, what it is that I feel. But I do know this, because I thought that – we talked about how I thought that Amazing Spider-Man 2 was respectful to the character of Spider-Man. And we disagreed about a few things, but I do feel like Bryan Singer respects these characters in the Kelsey Grammer beast. Bringing that back is saying, here he is. He exists. It's just – what I mean, it's like 3 seconds or 5 seconds. But it's enough to say, we know, and here you go.
Yeah. I mean, the one in this movie who obviously I think gets shortchanged the most is Halle Berry's Storm, who has always been a problem in the franchise, I think. I think, you know, she was miscast from the beginning, and – her career then really took off after she did X-Men because she won the Oscar after that. But they never really figured out not only what to do with her performance, but what to do with the character of Storm. And, of course, we all as X-Men fans who couldn't understand why they didn't cast Angela Bassett in the first place are truly upset because we all, you know, I can at least picture like, oh, she would know what to do with this character. And who knows, maybe they still wouldn't give her anything to do. Maybe it's just they don't know how to write that character, so she has nothing to do. Because in this movie, she exists to basically stand around and ultimately die, only to be reborn. But again, I like that she was there. I like that it was... that the movies all tie together in that way, that, that Halle Berry's Storm is still a part of the X-Men series.
Yeah, they've stuck with it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as the movie opens, I really liked the opening, and it was dark, and deliberately so. I mean, it's a lot of people dying, and we have to watch Iceman die twice, and Colossus die twice, and because the Sentinels are killing them off. And one of the things that I like, and this doesn't belong to me, I believe this was Matt Singer's observation over at The Dissolve, was that he said one of the things that this movie seems to be about or saying is, you know, we've seen some superhero movies go dark. It's kind of started with Christopher Nolan, and now some others have followed suit, and that this movie is saying, no, let's, that it's about moving away from the darkness and towards the light, you know, not just in that the 70s are... The 70s sequences in the movie are brighter and a little bit more energetic and less dark, but also that that's sort of what the movie is about, the journey of the character of Mystique from, no, you don't have to be this dark killer. You can embrace the good. And I really like that. And watching that opening sequence, it was neat because it was doing kind of what I said I liked about X-Men The Last Stand, which is just, it's very almost casual about the use of all these people's powers. It doesn't stop to say, oh, Kitty Pryde can phase through walls. It just shows her doing it. Everybody has these powers, and it doesn't stop for an individual display. It doesn't have to explain what everyone can do or what everyone is doing. It just throws us right into this world where everybody has powers and everyone's using them all at the same time as a way of advancing the story. And I thought that was really effective.
That's true. And they do just show characters using their powers. But since when does Kitty Pryde have the ability to send people's consciousnesses? Like, did I miss something?
Well, she's able to do it in the book Days of Future Past, and I don't know how it's explained in the book. She sends her own consciousness back, and I don't know how she does that. In this movie, they never bother to explain it.
I would have liked an explanation for that, because I don't remember that ever being one of her powers. And I know you're right, it is in the book, and that is how things get kicked off. But they just kind of go with it. And to your point, I mean, it works most of the time. But that's one instance for me that I was just like, wait, what?
Yeah, well, it's one of those things. You know, we saw Professor X blown to smithereens in X-Men The Last Stand. And there's a little post-credits thing where his voice is heard by Moira MacTaggert. And so we say, okay, he's not totally dead. Or Magneto lost his powers. But then, oh, the chess piece moves a little bit, so maybe he's going to get them back. And when last we saw these iterations of those characters, one was dead and one had no power. And now here they are, alive and with full power. And the movie never explains how that happened, and I almost don't care. Like, do we need the scene where it explains, well, here, you thought I was dead, but I was able to... Who cares? Like, these people come back to life all the time. I don't know. It didn't bother me that, okay, I just accept that they're back. And, yeah, it would have been great. I mean, I felt like the exposition in this movie is not handled particularly well. It's characters standing around having to explain things to one another. And so the way that it's that the plot kicks off in this movie is very much characters explaining, well, here's what we're going to do. And we're going to send your consciousness back in time to stop the Sentinels. And it kind of illustrates what happens. It's not particularly well handled. And yeah, I, like you, was wondering, well, how is she able to do that? But I also know, okay, I either accept this as a way of moving the movie forward, or I get hung up on that. And again, it's this weird thing where if a movie's not working for me, I become more critical because I start pulling things out and saying, okay, why isn't this working? And I start to really notice all of the flaws. And I still notice the flaws in a movie that I like, especially when they're glaring as they are at times in X-Men Days of Future Past. But if it is essentially working dramatically, I'm able to overlook certain things. And that's one of those things where it's like, well, I either accept this and let the movie continue to work for me dramatically, or I get hung up on that. And from that point on, my connection to the movie is broken.
Yeah, I almost feel like this movie needed Basil Exposition from Austin Powers to look at the audience and say, just relax and go along for the ride and you'll have a much better time.
Yeah, there were several expositional deliveries from several different characters that were problematic. I mean, it forces you to accept some things that to me are pretty stupid, like the whole idea that Charles Xavier is now walking, but it's because he's taking this serum that it makes his legs work, but it stops his powers. It's like, well, why? Okay. All right. Listen, I'll go along with it, but it's kind of dumb.
I was totally okay with it too. I was like, cause I was like in the trailers, I'm like, how is he walking?
Yeah, exactly.
He explains it. I'm like, oh, okay. Good enough.
Yeah. Not great, but okay.
Speaking of things that don't work, Quicksilver. I really do not feel like Quicksilver belongs in this movie. What about you?
Well, here's the thing. Because his scene is very much an isolated scene. And the scene works. It's fun. Where he runs around and we get the slow motion and we get the time in a bottle and ha ha ha, the 70s. And the scene is entertaining. And I thought his characterization was funny. I mean, I like the way the actor played him. And Evan Peters is his name. So it all works, right? Sort of. But then you stand outside of it for 2 seconds and you think, okay, well, A, I don't like the design, but obviously a lot of people called attention to that, just the bad silver jacket and the Pink Floyd t-shirt. That's all kind of obnoxious. And he doesn't resemble in any way Peter Maximoff from the comics. Okay, so he's not Quicksilver from the comics, whatever. But does he need to be in this movie? And ultimately, no, he doesn't. He's there as a fuck you to Marvel because of that whole issue where they sort of both have the rights. Mm-hmm. He's included, I feel like, because they could include him. Because obviously it could have been anyone. It doesn't make any sense that they just say, oh, I know a guy. And then they go get him and he runs around and then he's out of the movie. Like, if you're going to use him and make him matter into the rest of your story. So it's this weird cameo that's there just as a fuck you to Marvel. But I thought as a standalone scene, the scene still worked.
That scene really bothered me. I got to be honest with you. Maybe I'm just being particular and just shaking my cane at things that bother me. But So you go, first of all, he puts earphones on or headphones on, but he can't listen to music because he's going so fast. So that doesn't make sense.
Right.
And then if you put someone's fist up next to their face, that means they're going to be punching themselves in real time. That doesn't make sense.
No.
That's an entire scene built around things that make no sense to me, but it killed in the theater. So maybe that's just one of those things that I need to let go because it works for most people.
Well, I don't think Bryan Singer does fun really well. Like, rewatching even the first X-Men or the moments in Days of Future Past that are sort of supposed to be light or funny, I don't think he does that really well. I don't think he has a real good handle on that. And so it did feel like this little oasis of sort of fun in the middle of a movie that, while still, like, fun in a way, it's less fun in the superficial sense that the Quicksilver scene is fun, that the movie's just lightening up for one scene and having a little bit of comic relief. And I agree. I mean, again, it's asking you to accept things that are very, very false. And there are people who would say, oh, well, you can buy that this guy has a mutant power where he can run around real fast, but you can't buy that, you know, you put your fist up to his face and you punch. It's like, no, you have to meet the movie on its own reality. We've accepted the reality that people have superpowers and that they're mutants and that he can run around really fast, but now it has to work within that reality. And yeah, shit like putting the guy's hand up to his face, that's dumb. But I mean, the punchline did work for me when you sort of see the result of everything once it speeds up again. The time in a bottle thing I didn't love, and I thought Bryan Singer was doing a little bit too much of like the ha-ha, the 70s. He stopped fairly quickly when Wolverine first shows up. He's got the clothes and the car and the rabbit's foot keychain. It's a little bit much of like the, haha, aren't the 70s kitschy and funny? And I was worried that the movie was going to go down that road. And mostly from that point on, with a few exceptions, like some of the Quicksilver stuff or the Sanford and Son on the TV, I thought it generally ignored that kind of stuff.
The time in a bottle thing really, really annoyed me, and I feel like he has maybe learned the wrong lessons from Quentin Tarantino with some of the choices of music. Sure. film. But, you know, that's a cynical way to look at it. And I'll try not to let that bother me so much. But you're talking about Bryan Singer doesn't really do fun. How did it play for you, Wolverine walking through the metal detector, it not going off, and then he goes, huh?
I was pulled out of that moment because it's already been established that he has no metal. So why do we have that beat? Because it's already been established that he has not yet been laced with adamantium by William Stryker. He has his dumb bone claws. He hasn't gone through the Stryker thing yet. So why would his skeleton go off?
Yeah, it's just redundant, but it just brought the movie to a screeching halt for me. But again, it killed the theater. It was like,
well, rewatching the first X-Men, when they crash the X-Jet during the sort of terrible Statue of Liberty sequence at the end, James Marsden does this thing that to me is funny. He just goes, sorry. Like, his delivery of sorry is funny. And then because every movie becomes the Wolverine show, we have to have Hugh Jackman going, you call that a landing? Which isn't a funny line and steps on the funny sorry that James Marsden does. So it's that I feel like he makes some bad choices when it comes to what is supposed to be the comic relief in the series.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's from the Department of Redundancy Department.
And so much of it falls on Wolverine's shoulders, which it was interesting to me. First of all, I hate bone claws, so I was upset that bone claws are in this movie because when
why did they bother you so much?
I hate bone claws. I hate that even was ever a thing. I hate that it was retconned in the comic books because the whole thing was that Wolverine's claws are not his mutant power. Like, his healing factor is his mutant power. The claws were installed in him, for lack of a better word. So the bone claws thing really bothers me. And I know people that read Origin, you know, that's where bone claws come from. But I'm not a fan. I don't like the look of them. What's that?
It's not. No, it's not. It comes from, like, the Fatal Attraction storyline from, like, 1992. When did you stop reading? 1987.
No, I was still reading in 92, I think.
It goes way back. Magneto sucked the adamantium out of his pores, and that's what was left. And it's been around for like 20 years, more than 20 years. It's hilarious to me that you're like, I will buy this, but I will not buy bone claws.
I don't. It's not that I don't buy it. I don't like it. Yeah. I don't like how it looks. I don't like the whole thing. So this movie had a lot of bone claws, which bummed me out. I was happy to see the one appearance of the adamantium claws when he accidentally stabs Ellen Page, but not happy to see Ellen Page stabbed. She's Canadian. But I don't love the bone claws. But I thought it was interesting. The movie is much more about Charles Xavier and sort of his arc, which I thought was a good idea because the movies so often do become the Wolverine show. So I liked that it did try to still find a character for Wolverine, that he now has to be the guy that, you know, he has swapped places basically with Charles Xavier from the first X-Men. So it kind of brings things full circle. And he says as much in the movie. It's not subtle about these choices, where he says, you know, once upon a time, I was in your shoes and you convinced me to be a hero and to do good things and to fight for people that need it. And I thought that worked. You know, I was much less interested in Wolverine in this movie, and I was fascinated. I sort of applauded the fact, because so many of the movies do become the Wolverine show, that Bryan Singer essentially makes him irrelevant to the conclusion. It takes him out of the action. He doesn't get to be the big hero. It drowns him in a lake and leaves him sidelined as things resolve without him.
You know, that's a great point. I didn't even register that until you said that just now, but you're absolutely right. Everything does become the Wolverine show, but the things that he has to do in this movie, he's deeper than he's ever been. But you're right. I like that it's Charles's story at the end of the day. Well, and it's also Mystique's
story, right?
But you're right. You know, we haven't really seen that before, have we? I don't know that they've ever, because Wolverine was the linchpin for the first three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not in First Class, obviously, because he was not really in the movie.
He still appeared. Because
right.
Wolverine in everything.
Exactly. And he still, you know, is at the climax of this movie when he wakes up in a sequence that was so reminiscent of Inception that I actually think they should pay some royalties. That scene where he walks through the mansion, the music is very much inspired by the Hans Zimmer. It's called Time, that piece of music that I love so much from Inception. Very much inspired by that. Has that same quality of he walks through, am I dreaming? Is this real? And again, I liked the sequence because even seeing the one appearance of Anna Paquin, because she was cut out of the movie, even though she gets a very prominent credit in the end credits. Even seeing her with Iceman, I really liked, because when we last left her, she had chosen to get rid of her powers, and Iceman was like cheating on her with Kitty Pryde. And the movie acknowledges that in this movie, because in the apocalyptic future, they seem to sort of be together. But then when we go to the corrected current timeline, he's back with Rogue. And I was like, yeah, great. That's how it's supposed to be, right? But it's so much like Inception. It's crazy. My biggest complaint with the movie is sort of weird logic gaps and some bad choices. But like I said, I can overlook a lot of them. If I have an overall complaint or concern,
Peter Dinklage.
It's not Peter Dinklage, although he's not left with much to do.
No.
I mean, I've read people criticizing that he seems bored. I don't know that he seems bored. I don't think he has much of a part to play. But it is this. We get to the post-credits tag, which I assume you stuck around for?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I never read Age of Apocalypse, so I knew that they were doing Apocalypse next, and I put it together based on the four guys on horses in the background. But the fact that they are doing that does kind of excite me, and maybe he's a garbage character and maybe it's a shitty storyline. I have no idea, but...
Oh, Apocalypse is awesome.
Okay. I'm excited about it because I want to see an X-Men movie where the conflict is not us against the humans, where the villain is not a human who wants to rid the world of mutants, because we've had essentially four or five X-Men movies now, depending on, I mean, we'll include, I guess, First Class. The conflict is always the same. And there's an internal conflict also, the conflicting ideologies of Charles Xavier and Magneto, and that's where the real drama is. But in the first movie, it's the Senator, I want to get rid of the mutants. And in the second movie, it's Stryker, I want to get rid of the mutants. And in the third movie, it's the Cure, let's get rid of the mutants. And in Days of Future Past, it's a little bit, or not Days of Future Past, in First Class, it's more of an internal struggle, but there's still this, let's kill the mutants with the missiles. And now in this movie, it's Oliver Trask or whatever. Let's build Sentinels and get rid of the mutants. So they just keep doing essentially the same story. And so I'm interested to see a movie where Apocalypse is the villain, where it's not about, we're mutants and we're being persecuted, where it's much more about just fighting a villain with powers, you know?
Yeah, it's the hallmark of X-Men has always been that outcast element, the metaphors for whatever discrimination,
which is great. I love that about the movie, and that's one of the things that I really liked about the original X-Men. Right. I've seen it enough times now.
Well, that's what I was going to say. But that's not all that X-Men has been.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's like in the third or fourth issue, they're fighting some guy who's, you know, trying to take over such and such. I mean, they were constantly facing threats that had nothing to do with politics or discrimination. And I need a human element to connect to these stories, like Captain America, the Winter Soldier, whatever. If you're going to have this big spectacle, give me something to connect to first. And I feel like they've done that now with these X-Men movies, and I'm actually okay with them taking that to the next level where we can see X-Men fight Apocalypse. But I don't know that I would have been before this movie. So this movie has done a ton of heavy lifting to put things in a position where now, I mean, the sky is the limit.
Did the sort of retconning that took place in this movie, has that gotten actually rid of that aspect of the story? Because what it argues is that Mystique becomes a hero. So does that mean that mutants beginning in the 70s up until present day are accepted?
I have no idea. And the thing about time travel and alternate continuity or whatever, so they can probably do whatever they want to with it.
Explain to me also at the end when we flash back to, I thought we were going to get brought up to speed on what happened with Wolverine after he drowned at the bottom of the lake. They bring him up, he's alive, and Stryker says, I'll take him, and I assume that means Wolverine is still going to basically have the same origin. Stryker takes him, experiments on him, laces him with adamantium, makes him Weapon X. That brings us back to where he is in the first X-Men. But then we find out it's actually Mystique. So now are they retconning Wolverine's entire origin? Is he ever going to get adamantium going forward, or is it just Bone Claws? Because if it is, I want the next X-Men to be called X-Men Bone Claws.
And you will not be going to see that.
I will not.
No, I think that it's still supposed to be Stryker, but I think the implication now is that Stryker was maybe Mystique all along. I don't know.
But that doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense. I don't know what that was, but that's what I took from it. It's like, oh, so Stryker isn't even Stryker? Or maybe she's just pretending. It can be whatever they want it to be, really.
I guess, and I wonder if that's even going to be paid off. I assume it will. It seems it was really the only example of sort of a cliffhanger in this movie, except for, you know, the post-credits scene. One of the other things I liked, and also one of the things that I didn't necessarily like, although now they could theoretically change it? No, they can't. I believe Bryan Singer kind of set out to say, we're not killing off any characters. And by that, I guess he means we're going to kill off every character, but it won't take. So we get to see a lot of the X-Men that we know and love die repeatedly, but they don't stay dead. And that was, again, one of the issues with Last Stand, was that it killed off several major characters and took the powers away from several others. So it was nice to see them not feel like, okay, to raise the stakes, we're going to kill Mystique. To raise the stakes, we're going to kill Magneto in this alternate timeline. At the same time, it does make mention of several characters from First Class being killed off. Azazel was killed, Banshee was killed, Emma Frost was killed. And because that technically took place before the timeline split, doesn't that mean that those characters are permanently dead?
My ears just started bleeding.
Exactly. I ask because it means we can never get an Emma Frost again, which I'm okay with. But I also think that she can be an interesting character if they don't go too cheesecake with her and figure out what to do with her. I think she could be interesting if they were going to tell stories with her going forward again, as long as they, A, don't cast January Jones, and B, don't cast her just to wear that costume that she wears in the books, because she's sort of one of the most offensive characters to me, the way she's drawn.
Yeah, no, she existed for nothing more than cheesecake sex appeal.
Yeah, right. And fetish. For me, that's Beast.
Fetish. Yeah. So this brings me back to, oh my gosh, my head is like spinning. do you think, that's why I was asking about Rebecca Romijn. Do you think that they're not bringing certain characters back as a, I don't know, as a statement? Like, so did they kill Emma Frost as a statement? Is that some message about, you know, January Jones' performance? That's why I was asking about Rebecca Romijn, because there are some conspicuous absences. When they go out of their way to bring so many people in and you have those absences, I was wondering about that.
Well, okay, so here's the deal. You know, sometimes they say, oh, that character died just because they aren't going to, you know, they couldn't bring the actor back or whatever. And in this case, I feel like they tried to give it some dramatic weight because that was one of the reasons why Mystique gets so upset. That was the reason that Magneto was so angry and felt abandoned by Charles Xavier. But ultimately, I felt it was more about just like, well, we don't want to pay for those actors. And January Jones was really the dead spot of dead spots on First Class. With Rebecca Romijn, I feel like it could be just that they're really trying to hitch their wagon to Jennifer Lawrence because she's an Oscar winner. She's a huge movie star right now. And so they're lucky to have signed her to a contract before she really blew up. So they're allowed to use her for a couple more movies. And maybe they want to sort of refigure Mystique going forward. I will say I like Jennifer Lawrence as an actress. I did not think she was terrific in this movie. She was fine. I guess she served the part okay, but I felt like a lot of other actors were outshining her. For Rebecca Romijn to exist, though, in the futuristic timeline, she technically has no powers because that timeline is concurrent with what happened in Last Stand. So she lost her powers in that movie, so she wouldn't figure into that. And then she wouldn't be in the past because that's Jennifer Lawrence. So the only time we could have seen Rebecca Romijn really would have been when Logan wakes up in the mansion.
All right. Does this movie establish how much time has passed between The Last Stand?
I don't think it says. I mean, it says it's been 50 years from the 70s stuff. So between the stuff we see in the 70s, whatever year that is supposed to be, and the future stuff is 50 years.
Okay.
So I guess maybe 20 years, if it's been about 30 since – I don't know. I don't think it ever flat out says.
But so they've given themselves room that they can do – I mean, they could have fit anything into that yeah. they do, I guess.
I know enough time has passed for Logan's temples to gray.
I know, that which is weird because he's not supposed to age like that.
No, because when we see him in First Class, he still looks the exact same. So why? It's a little bit ridiculous that his temples were grayed.
Basil exposition. Just.
So I like all the stuff with the powers. I agree. I was reading some criticism that it makes no sense for Magneto to move that baseball stadium onto the White House lawn. While I liked the shot, when we finally see what it is he's doing, he's created this fortress around the White House. It didn't go anywhere. It didn't become like, haha, now you're cut off. It was just this thing that he did, and it felt kind of like that bridge moving sequence from Last Stand. So it is kind of pointless. And I read one speculation where somebody said, no, Bryan Singer has basically said it was there just almost as an effects demo reel, as a way of making this feel like a big expensive summer movie. So that's a bummer because it was a moment that really could have gone somewhere, but didn't. But for me, as much as I enjoyed all the uses of powers and all the fighting, you know, again, it still felt, you really only have a couple mutant characters running around in the 70s. It's really just Beast, Wolverine, Magneto, and Mystique, because even Charles Xavier isn't really using his powers. So it was kind of limited in that way. And then the power displays in the apocalyptic future are limited only by the screen time. So for me, the best stuff was like when Magneto and Charles have that first confrontation on the plane after they break him out.
Yes.
I mean, those two guys together, that's fucking money in the bank. Like, anytime you can have those guys acting in a scene together, they elevate it so much. Their shit is so good. I think both of them are so well cast and give such good, interesting performances. I was a fan of, you know, Patrick Stewart as a no-brainer casting. I was a fan of Ian McKellen as sort of left field casting. At the time, it was like, really? Oh, okay. And then he gives a performance that goes beyond what we thought would come in a comic book movie. And so I like what he does, but man, Fassbender and James McAvoy, I think, are so terrific that sometimes I wish we could just stay with those versions of the characters.
That's exactly what I was going to say, is I just want to see them. In fact, you know, I'd even like to see a movie that's just about their relationship with no powers. You know, here's what I want: a romance movie. Fassbender and James McAvoy, where they just, you know, work through their issues and love each other a little bit more at the end of the day. I would gladly watch that movie.
Well, originally we were going to get a Magneto spin-off movie back when
that.
Well, Origins was so shitty that I feel like they decided maybe not to go down that path and instead rebooted the series with First Class. And I'm really happy about that. I mean, I don't think Wolverine should have his own movie. I don't think Magneto should have his own movie. As much as I love Fassbender, as much as I wish some of his stuff at the beginning of First Class was its own movie.
Yeah.
Because I love all that shit. I like X-Men for the team stuff. I like the team dynamic. And I like the way that they have to work as a team, and that's sort of what each of the movies is about. We have these different ideas about what we should be, about what our place in the world is, but we have to learn to, you know, put aside our differences and work together for the greater good. And again, it is becoming repetitive because it's been that over and over and over again. But I like that story, and I think it's a story worth telling. I think this movie has some things to say about... I don't want to get political at all, and obviously there is another tragic shooting this weekend as we're recording this by a guy who just was depressed, mentally ill, felt hopeless, felt unloved, and it's horrible, and it's sad, and, you know, fuck that guy a million times. I say it's sad for the victims, but to know that there are people out there in this world, I mean, at least here is a movie that costs $200 million and is this dumb summer blockbuster, and I hate to even equate these two, but all I'm saying is that the message of this movie is you don't have to be that thing. You don't have to be a killer. The answer to the people that wrong you does not have to be murder them and take them out. You can be something better. And as horrible as it is to even invoke this tragedy in a discussion of X-Men Days of Future Past, I just feel like it's saying something that I think is worth saying.
Well, that's absolutely true. Our art is a reflection of us. And this movie is clearly saying you are responsible for your actions and you don't have to be the worst. You can be better. You can fight through it and come out on the other side. And then they show you that happening. And
right.
Yes, it's wonderful. The themes in this movie really come across.
And again, to put it in the context more of sort of the last run of summer blockbusters, I think there are some movies that sometimes try to say other things. I mean, again, I don't want to get back into Spider-Man, but it never really figures out what Spider-Man symbolizes or why or what he has to sacrifice or any of those things. It is a movie that's hopeful and positive.
We were talking about the themes in this movie and the lack of themes that you found in Amazing Spider-Man 2, but Winter Soldier also had some pretty good themes. So I'd like to think that we're on the cusp of something, or maybe even in the middle of something, where our superhero entertainment is carrying some deeper themes and some a little bit more weight than they have. You know, look at X-Men in 2000, and then look at this movie, and look at everything that's come in between, and I don't know, it's kind of a remarkable progress that's been made in those years as to what we're – the issues that we're able to tackle in the form of a superhero movie when done well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're definitely at a point where we're holding superhero movies almost to a standard that is separate from – what we hold other movies to. And maybe it's because there's more conversation about them in certain communities, which you and I, you know, both frequent, maybe movie sites or just online kind of stuff. And, you know, I think we're at the point now where we can just sort of say, like, yeah, some of them are good and some of them are bad, just like all movies. They are a microcosm of all movies in that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and they can't all be great. But to me, X-Men has always had more on its mind, and some of that is just because of what the source material is. But you go back to 2000, Bryan Singer opened the first X-Men movie, and I remember being really kind of jarred by this when I saw the movie opening day in 2000. It opens in a concentration camp, and right off the bat, he tells you, this is about something bigger. This isn't just about people with powers. This is about what happens in a society when we brand people as different and not worthy of being alive.
I
mean, that really hit me when I saw it in the first movie. And so for the most part, that has been carried through. X-Men 2 is a little bit more comic booky. X-Men 3 is super comic booky and almost loses that thread. And X-Men 3 or X-Men The Last Stand also kind of needs to fuck off. I know I said I like things about it, but it not only does it fuck up the Dark Phoenix storyline, but it also fucks up. Did you read Joss Whedon's run on Astonishing X-Men?
Yes.
I really loved it.
Yeah.
And that's where that whole Cure storyline came from. And that movie just kind of borrowed that wholesale and also kind of fucked that up, I thought.
Yeah. There's just no one at the wheel. I mean, they had all... When you have all the tools and you have all this work that's been done and then just, never mind,
Well, again, they were trying to hit a release date, and I just
Should never come before the product that you're making.
But it's happening a lot. I mean, look at how many release dates we have 4 or 5 years out now that movies are claiming this weekend in 2018. It's like, no. Let's make a good movie and then figure out when to put it out. Or let's even figure out if by 2018 we need to tell this story anymore. You know, we've kind of seen what has happened with Spider-Man. Worldwide, it's made a bunch of money, but domestically, it's not a flop, but it's underperforming in a big way. It's made less than half of what the first Sam Raimi made domestically. And you're talking about an IMAX upcharge. You're talking about a 3D upcharge. You're talking about ticket inflation. You're talking about a budget that's considerably larger. There's no reason why its grosses should be less than 50%, except people might be burned out on it, or your movies have not been as good. And so to say in 2018, we're still going to be making these things no matter what, to me is a bit of a bummer. I was even bummed out when they announced before Days of Future Past came out, yeah, next we're doing Apocalypse. It's like, no, assholes, let's wait and see how you did with Days of Future Past. And if it's good, I'll say, yeah, go ahead, do Apocalypse. But if they had come out with something on the level of The Last Stand or, God forbid, X-Men Origins Wolverine, would there be anyone looking for them to do Apocalypse?
No. Thank goodness they stuck the landing.
Yeah, I feel like they did for the most part. Again, we could probably do a whole show that just says, like, oh, and what's with this? And isn't this kind of stupid? And this part sucked. But I'm generally not interested in that because I liked the movie about as much as I've liked at least, you know, three of the other X-Men movies.
Yeah, you know, Eric Aschberger said something. He tweeted something, I don't know, a week or so ago about when – and you said it earlier in this podcast, but when something's working for you, you're willing to excuse the things that don't work for you. And this movie has so many things that I feel like do work that the other stuff just isn't important. It's just nitpicks.
Right.
Don't amount to anything because what is there is substantial enough to make the other things – that's not important.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. When I start to really pull something apart is when it's a shapeless blob at the center. And yeah. Now, you know, the last two movies I've seen this summer fit that bill. And Prometheus is a great example where I didn't feel like my problems with Prometheus were nitpicking because I just felt like there was no center. It was just this crazy mix of bad ideas and potential, but bad ideas. And so there wasn't anything for me to grab onto and then pick from the sides. It was all just there to be pulled apart. Whereas this movie, I feel like, has a strong center, not just thematically, but in the relationship at the center between Xavier and Magneto in those two performances, in the character of Mystique as a symbol of, well, you could be this or you could be this. And I disagree with the fact that it was Mystique, that they had to make her so important. But I also think that some of that groundwork was at least laid by First Class. I didn't feel like they were rewriting the trajectory of their story just to make Jennifer Lawrence the center. Because she kind of... First Class was already sort of the story of the battle for her soul, that she grew up with Charles Xavier and that she eventually goes over to Magneto and what he represents. So that groundwork was kind of laid. And so I feel like at least making her so central to this and making this movie, you know, essentially about the continued battle for her soul, was earned and not a cheat.
I don't feel like anything in this movie was a cheat. I feel like everything that came... Well, maybe not everything, but most of the things in this movie had foundation laid movies ago. One movie, two movie, three movies ago. And it all kind of has organically come to this point. Now, it took some great writing to do it. But everything – I feel like it's a tree that everything has grown into this one direction. I don't know. That doesn't make any sense. But you know what I'm trying to say.
I do. I almost feel like – are you a Fast and Furious fan?
Yeah, you know I am.
This is kind of like the Fast Five of the series. And Fast Five is super entertaining, and I might even argue more entertaining than this movie is because it's just fun. But Fast Five, to me, was the movie that pulled all the previous ones together in a way that, A, recontextualized them and made them work, and B, incorporated all of them. Didn't just ignore the ones that it didn't like. Because the fact that they even flash back to clips from X-Men The Last Stand in this movie, or use Kelsey Grammer as Beast, it would have been real easy for them to say, oh yeah, that shit never happened. Last Stand didn't exist. And totally gloss over it. But they didn't. They acknowledged, oh no, those things, that movie existed. We all saw it. We know that it's there. And Kelsey Grammer played Beast, and here he is. And yeah, Wolverine killed Jean Grey at the end of it. And so we're going to show him flash back to that, as bad as it was. Fast Five kind of did that, where that was the movie that pulled together all of the disparate movies from the previous franchise, where here's this crazy movie in Miami, Too Fast, Too Furious, and here's this Tokyo Drift movie that takes place in an alternate reality, and here's the fourth one that's kind of grim and not good, and Fast Five pulled it all together. And that, to me, is what Days of Future Past was, that it pulled together all of the past X-Men movies that vary in quality, that vary in sort of, not timeline, but, you know, you have the reboot stuff, and you have the Singer stuff, and this movie managed to pull it all together in a way that was generally satisfying.
Yeah, I don't even have anything to add to that. It's just the total redemption for things that kind of worked, half worked. It has elevated things to this epic level now where everything is a piece of the whole.
Yeah, it has me looking forward to another X-Men movie, which I haven't for a while.
I know.
Probably since the end of X2, when we got that tease of Dark Phoenix. I was like, oh my god, I can't wait for the next one. And so that's going back to, what, 2002, 2003?
Oh, so over a decade. We've been in the wilderness for over 10 years.
Which, again, isn't to say that I didn't like First Class, but just nothing about it had me like, oh, I can't wait for the next one, you know?
Yeah, well, aside from the casting, because that cast, again, with Fassbender and McAvoy, I would watch them. I want to see them read the phone book. Anything. Or Fassbender, McAvoy.
They are pretty awesome. Yeah. All right. So I guess we'll wrap it up. Thank you guys very much for listening. Thank you, Heath.
Well, thank you, Patrick.
And we'll see you guys next week. Mark Ahn will return to the show, and I believe we're going to be talking about Tombstone, which, Heath, you are a fan, correct?
I'm your Huckleberry.
We'll see you guys next week.